Many Amina communities face a harsh reality, and that is racist sociopolitical pressures, which can lead to the gradual erosion or silencing of one's identity and culture. So finding ways to heal, to connect, and reignite one's identity may require multiple ways to tap into different ways of relating to the self. How might music play a role in that healing process? And imagine connecting with and through music. And what are some therapeutic applications? Imagine what emotions and memories arise when you think about your favorite song. Are you laughing? Are you dancing? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Sun. As part of our Arab American Heritage series, today we have Manal Topazada, the founder and executive director of Notable Music Therapy Services. With more than 25 years experience in hospital, forensic, education, mental health, addiction, and community settings, Manal is an internationally recognized authority on community-based music therapy. Her current interests lie primarily in the area of mental health and addiction. Manal has presented throughout the United States and in Europe, and is the Western Regional Representative to the American Music Therapy Association's Internship Approval Committee. As a member of the Nevada State Music Therapy Task Force, she helped draft Senate Bill 190, which created a state license that oversees the profession of music therapy in Nevada. Manal is a professional violinist and adjunct faculty at the School of Public Health at the University of Nevada in Reno. As an Egyptian-American music therapist, Manal will be discussing the importance of considering music towards the process of healing and the cultural connection of music for Amina communities. Manal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be able to chat with you today.
Yeah, I would love to know more about music therapy and more about what you do. Why don't you tell us some of the projects that you're involved with?
Yeah, so I'll start off with a brief, you know, kind of elevator speech for music therapy. And so music therapy is the use of music in clinical therapeutic relationships to achieve non-musical goals. So as music therapists, we're working on similar goals that, let's say, speech therapists, occupational therapists, et cetera, may be working on, but we're using music as our primary tool. It is a big part of the work that I do. I founded an organization in Reno, Nevada called Notable Music Therapy Services, which is a community-based music therapy nonprofit organization that sees about 2,500 people per year in a variety of settings.
Wow. And so for people who don't know much about music therapy, you mentioned, you know, applying music and therapeutic goals. And I'm actually on your website, and it's quite phenomenal, some of the interventions that music therapy is involved in. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how that may interplay with just some of challenges that people struggle with? How's it done or conducted? People who just don't know much about music therapy, tell us more about that.
You know, music is one of the really, really interesting things because it is everywhere. And because it is everywhere, we don't really appreciate the power and the potential of the modality. From a very basic level, if you think about our brains have evolved to have certain areas of our brain specialize in certain things, right? So we have a visual cortex, we have a motor cortex that our brain specializes in. We don't have a music center in our brain. And so really, from an evolutionary perspective, this can speak to one of two things. This can speak to either the fact that music is so unimportant to us as humans that our brains are just, whatever, haven't spent any time thinking about music. Or it can speak to the fact that music is so integral and so important to us as human beings that it is too important to have any one part of our brain specialize in. And that's a really fascinating thing if you think about it, because music is processed in and affects every single part of our brain, from, you know, the higher functions. It helps us with speech, it helps us with movement, it helps us learn, retain, recall information, all the ways that music can affect us both physiologically, neurologically, and psychologically.
Yeah.
So that was a very, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, seeing and reading about how music really helps and benefits with memory. And in fact, on your website, you're talking about neurologic music therapy, and it's being used for people who struggle with dementia. Just beyond the clinical application of music, I want to think about it more from also a cultural connection and a healing effort. You know, because we are in Arab American Heritage Month, what are some of the intersections of healing and music, particularly in the Amina communities?
And I'm really glad you pointed that out. In addition to the physiological and neurological impact of music, music affects us and impacts us from a basic cultural level of connection. There are some theories that music is how we first came together as humans. And if you think about it, that makes sense, right? Drumming, singing, dancing, that is what brings us together. There has never been a culture throughout time or throughout the geography of the world that has not had music as an integral part of their culture. And every culture has a slightly different relationship with music. In the Mina culture, specifically, my family is from Egypt, so I speak mostly from an Egyptian kind of Mediterranean, Middle Eastern perspectives. There is a different relationship to music than there is in Western culture. So in Western culture, we tend to put the arts and music into the domains of two groups of people. One is kids. So when you're a child, you're welcome to sing and dance and make noise and paint and express yourself. And then the other group is the talented. So in Western culture, when you grow up, we don't own those parts of ourselves unless we are considered to be talented. So we put away art unless we're an artist. We put away music unless we're a musician. Part of my work as a music therapist is informed by my culture of origin. That relationship to music is very different. There's a much greater sense of ownership of folk songs, of traditional songs, of music being part of everyday life. It doesn't matter whether you can sing, whereas in Western culture, you have to be a singer to sing. Does that make sense?
Totally, totally makes sense. And it's so fascinating as you're describing this, because it didn't occur to me that that was how we were thinking about it. But in reality, that's sort of how it's conceptualized. And in many ways, it dampens and washes away this part of identity that we carry. It's not part of the common cultural vernacular that, hey, I embody this musical art talent, and it's just a part of who I am, this holistic being.
Absolutely. And I find it very, very sad. And that's part of my work as a music therapist, is getting people or helping people reconnect with those parts of ourselves that make us the most human. We tend to think of music and the art as flux, right? So if you think about traditional Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you have to have all of these basic things met, and then you can have self-actualization and music and all these things. And I fundamentally do not believe that that is true. I think we have to have art and music and creativity and self-expression as part of our human existence, no matter where we are in this made up pyramid that we have of needs. And yeah, and again, like I said, in Middle Eastern culture and Arab culture and Egyptian culture, it's a much different relationship, because we want to hold on to that music, those songs. They're so tied into our sense of identity that they belong to everybody in a way that we don't see in the Western culture.
Yeah. Gosh, your music really does bring a sense of life. I do know that one thing I actually enjoy with the podcasting, in addition to getting to know people and hearing about the stories, is during the editing process, I go back and I'm listening to our conversations and I'm thinking what sort of emotion gets evoked in my conversations with the guests. And I try to search for music that connect with that emotion and try to include that. And I actually enjoyed that. That's just a little bit of my reactions when you talked about music. your work in music therapy, and I just thought, oh, this is fascinating. We really need to have Manal on the podcast. So now, Manal, I'm wondering too, what other additional insights might you want to share with us and our listeners, particularly in the context of healing and music therapy for AMENA populations or communities?
Well, there are a couple of things I think, thinking, especially since we're talking specifically Arab American Month and in the context of people who are living in this country, so immigrants, possibly first generation, I think understanding, or at least being aware of, the importance of holding on to music from culture of origin. And this is especially true throughout the lifespan and as people age. I saw this in my own life with my father, who was born and raised in Egypt and lived here for most of his adult life. And he grew up listening to the music of his generation, which was, you know, the Beatles and Elvis and all of those things. But then, of course, grew up listening to Egyptian music and Arabic music. And he had emotional responses to that we were able to connect to him through was the music from his childhood, the Arabic music that he grew up with. And I think just us being aware of that was so powerful because it helped us maintain a connection to him. Well, I'm not sure if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And thank you so much for sharing that with us, because for families who have someone with Parkinson's or dementia, these are very challenging conditions for folks to live with. And then to lose sometimes speech, to sometimes lose memories, the way to connect is through music. And I imagine that must have been just so much more meaningful for you.
Yes, absolutely. And then also, you know, for us to be able to connect with him by listening to and singing the music from his younger years, that also helped us with our identity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Especially, I think right now too, when we're talking about maybe first generation, third, you know, second or third generation, sometimes the language may eventually phase out, unfortunately, and a way to connect with identity and culture may be to go back to some of the music. And honestly, music makes learning language much easier, more fun.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, that is how none of us learn our ABCs through speaking, right? I mean, that is how we as humans, again, learn, retain, and recall information. And so music can be really powerful. And I love that you just said, even when we can't speak, we can still connect through music.
Yeah. Now, you know, you've definitely done a lot of work. I mean, spearheading, drafting the Senate bill or advocating for that and turn it into action. Can you share with us any memorable events and circumstances that influenced how you got into this work?
You know, that's such a funny question. I'm sure anybody in these sorts of fields gets that question, but especially for music therapists, because it is such a unique field. And so usually the follow-up question to what is music therapy is, getting into the field of music therapy was really just a combination of my undergraduate work in music and psychology and anthropology, which were the three things that I studied. And I went and actually studied Arabic music at the conservatory in Cairo for a while. And that process really helped me realize that I did not want to study music and anthropology in a theoretical way. I didn't want to study it in that academic way. I wanted to find ways to use music in the context of people's lives and in context of their lived experiences. And that led me down the path of becoming a music therapist.
Oh, wow. You know, this is actually very exciting to hear that you studied Arabic music, because I know you and I talked before the recording and we were mentioning, and I think how music therapy is being taught oftentimes is reflected with classical music or something. I'm unclear, like what type of music Is there like a curriculum that says, oh, you know, like for instance, with therapy, it's like, oh, you learn DBT, CBT, psychodynamic theory. So is there like a framework per se with music therapy?
Yeah, so music therapy is an interdisciplinary field. So if you do a graduate degree in music therapy, you usually specialize in something. And I specialized, my specialty was psychology within music therapy. Music therapy as a field is very heavily focused on Western values and Western training with regard to music. So one unfortunate result of this is as a field, it tends to automatically weed out people who are not trained in classical Western music. So even to get into music therapy school, you have to have a primary instrument. You have to be able to read music. You have to be able to sight read music. You have to be able to transpose songs. So you have to have a very strong Western foundation as a musician before you can even go into a program. And unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of amazing musicians and amazing potential music therapists may have never learned to read Western music, but they can play by ear phenomenally. They may not know music theory, but they can play, you know, any instrument you put in front of them. And those individuals are all too often excluded from even going into this field because they don't meet this very narrow criteria of what a musician should be and then what a music therapist should be.
Gosh, that is so unfortunate. You talked about the barrier into, I guess, getting into music therapy. I am curious, in your career as a person of color, what were some challenges that you faced and overcame that you would be willing to share?
Well, from a musical perspective, I was raised in a very Western classical musical tradition. My mom is an amazing pianist and taught piano for 30 years. And I grew up playing piano and violin. And, you know, I went that route. So from a musical standpoint, I had no issues going into the field of music therapy. I'm going to use this term because it's been used about me several times. I have been called ethnically ambiguous more than once. And as an ethnically ambiguous Arab, I have really used this privilege of passing more than I'd like to admit. And I recognize 100% that it is a privilege. And it has definitely made my professional life much easier in some ways. It has also really had an impact on my identity. And I share this as a sort of a seminal event in my professional development and my identity. Many years ago, this is dating me, I was doing my clinical internship at Oregon State Hospital. And during that time, there was the Oklahoma City bombing. I don't know if you were around during that time or remember. And of course, you know, this was before social media and it came on the news and there was a bombing and nobody really knew what happened. And my supervisor, my clinical supervisor, took me aside to caution me very out of the goodness of their heart, you know, really with the best intentions, to caution me to not let patients know that I was Arab because my people, in quotes, my people probably did this, so it's better to be safe.
Oh my gosh.
It was very well-intentioned. Looking back, of course, in my mind, wildly inappropriate. But that advice in that moment in my clinical internship, that advice just went to the core of me and it has stuck with me for nearly 30 years, really. This, because your people may be doing these things, it is better that you hide who you are because it'll be safer for you as a therapist.
You must have been shaken when you heard that.
I remember my very first memory of knowing in some way that I was different was in elementary school. I remember some kids pulling me aside or calling me out on the playground. And this is during the Iran hostage crisis. And he said, "Your people are keeping our people hostage," and then ran away. Not the slightest idea what he was talking about at the time, but that's a memory that stuck. And so when this happened during my internship, it was it shook me a little bit, but it also was just kind of just another nail in there in the coffin of my identity, I guess, it's a weird way to say it, but another reinforcement. Okay. Yes, it's better. We just don't let anyone know who we are.
Yeah. It's an identity and cultural erasure. So rather than being erased, one of our goal for the podcast, as well as particularly in this month, to uplift the voices and experiences of Arab Americans. For you, what does it mean to be an Egyptian American music therapist?
Well, I think, like so many people, for me, being Egyptian American, Arab American therapist and academic, also in my capacity as adjunct faculty at our university here, it almost always means that I am the only one of my kind, right? I'm the only Arab, I'm the only Muslim, I'm very often the only first generation American. And this absolutely is not a bad thing. It's just something that I'm sure, like many other people, it's something I'm very acutely aware of in most settings. One way that this affects me in my daily existence and in my professional life is that I tend to be drawn to the only sort of other ones in any given setting, if that makes sense. You know, I'm drawn to people who also seem to be a little on the margins. And I really do think that this is a strength of mine as a therapist, and definitely a strength working in community-based settings with diverse populations. But it also is something that I have to be very aware of, because it can lead to a sense of over-identification and transference working with clients you're on the margins, let me bring you in. I identify with you more than I do with these other people. So it's just something I think that really benefits me as a therapist, but also something I need to be very, very aware of.
Yeah, it's great you have that acknowledgement and insight, because, you know, I think a lot of BIPOC folks, when we are trying to help other people or even people within our own community, there's a sense we want to connect, yet we want to have a healthy balance of not over-identifying and then, of course, falling into this white savior complex.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, is there anything else you want to add?
So one thing that I think also is very important for people to remember is, because music does impact us so deeply on so many different levels, music is not always a positive thing. Music actually has the potential to cause harm. And so that's just something, when people are thinking about music, using music as a tool within the therapeutic process, that's something to be very aware of. And this again goes to music's capacity to, you know, trigger emotions, trigger memories in a way second only to smell. And we all know this intuitively, right? So we hear a song from our high school prom and we are immediately transported back there. Or we hear a song, you know, from our childhood, we are immediately transported back there. And that's happening on very basic levels in our brain. And so I think it's very important to be aware that, because music does have this power, it can impact people in a way. It can, you know, bring up memories, it can trigger experiences of trauma in ways that then you have to be ready to hold and deal with and process. And so it's really important, even though we're talking about music and its power to connect with culture and identity, it's also very important for people, you know, not any help in therapy, it can also be counterproductive and even harmful.
Yeah, that totally makes sense when we're thinking about the context of trauma work. And, you know, when we want people to go back to connect with emotions, sometimes those memories can also be difficult emotions and difficult memories.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
When you think of Arabic music, what comes up for you?
So when I think about Arabic music, I of course think about my parents, my grandparents, and I did spend summers in Egypt. I spent time in Egypt growing up, and that music was ever present both when I was there and when I was here. So I can hear a song by Abd al-Halim Hafez or Umm al-Kathoum or some very, you know, well-known Egyptian singers of yore, and I might not know the name of the song, I might not know the lyrics, I might not have any idea what they're singing about, but that music just triggers feelings of nostalgia and comfort and home.
All right, Manel, well, thank you so much for being on our show today. Thank you for your work and commitment. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me today. I just really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these two parts of my life and myself that I'm very passionate about.
A huge thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, please share and subscribe to People of Color in Psychology. You can also support us by registering for continuing education courses or making a one-time donation on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. Their feedback is important to us, so feel free to send an email, a message on LinkedIn, or leave a voice message on our website. Until next time, this is your host, Jack Sutton.